of Dublin streets. On his long and rather large head grew dry black hair, and a tawny moustache did not quite cover an unamiable mouth. His cheekbones also gave his face a harsh character, but there was no harshness in the eyes, which, looking at the world from under their tawny eyebrows, gave the impression of a man ever alert to greet a redeeming instinct in others, but often disappointed. He lived at a little distance from his body, regarding his own acts with doubtful side glances. He had an odd autobiographical habit which led him to compose in his mind from time to time a short sentence about himself containing a subject in the third person and a predicate in the past tense. He never gave alms to beggars and walked firmly, carrying a stout hazel. He had been for many years cashier of a private bank in Baggot Street. Every morning he came in from Chapel Izzard by tram. At midday he went to Dan Burke's and took his lunch, a bottle of lager beer and a small trayful of arrowroot biscuits. At 4 o'clock he was set free. He dined in an eating house in George's Street, where he felt himself safe from the society of Dublin's gilded youth, and where there was a certain plain honesty in the bill of fare. His evenings were spent either before his landlady's piano, or roaming about the outskirts of the city. His liking for Mozart's music brought him sometimes to an opera or a concert. These were the only dissipations of his life. He had neither companions nor friends, church nor creed. He lived his spiritual life without any communion with others, visiting his relatives at Christmas and escorting them to the cemetery when they died. He performed these two social duties for old dignity's sake, but conceded nothing further to the conventions which regulate the civic life. He allowed himself to think that in certain circumstances he would rob his bank, but as these circumstances never arose, his life rolled out evenly, an adventureless tale. One evening he found himself sitting beside two ladies in the rotunda. The house, thinly peopled and silent, gave distressing prophecy of failure. The lady who sat next to him looked round at the deserted house once or twice and then said, "What a pity there is such a poor house tonight. It's so hard on people to have to sing to empty benches." He took the remark as an invitation to talk. He was surprised that she seemed so little awkward. While they talked, he tried to fix her permanently in his memory. When he learned that the young girl beside her was her daughter, he judged her to be a year or so younger than himself. Her face, which must have been handsome, had remained intelligent. It was an oval face with strongly marked features. The eyes were very dark blue and steady. Their gaze began with a defiant note, but was confused by what seemed a deliberate swoon of the pupil into the iris, revealing for an instant a temperament of great sensibility. The pupil reasserted itself quickly. This half-disclosed nature fell again under the reign of prudence, and her astrakhan jacket, moulding a bosom of a certain fullness, struck the note of defiance more definitely. He met her again a few weeks afterwards at a concert in Earlsford Terrace, and seized the moments when her daughter's attention was diverted to become intimate. She alluded once or twice to her husband, but her tone was not such as to make the allusion a warning. Her name was Mrs. Sinico. Her husband's great-great-grandfather had come from Leghorn. Her husband was captain of a mercantile boat, plying between Dublin and Holland, and they had one child. Meeting her a third time by accident, he found courage to make an appointment. She came. This was the first of many meetings. They met always in the evening and chose the most quiet quarters for their walks together. Mr. Duffy, however, had a distaste for underhand ways, and finding that they were compelled to meet stealthily, he forced her to ask him to her house. Captain Sinico encouraged his visits, thinking that his daughter's hand was in question. He had dismissed his wife so sincerely from his gallery of pleasures that he did not suspect that anyone else would take an interest in her. As the husband was often away and the daughter out giving music lessons, Mr. Duffy had many opportunities of enjoying the lady's society. Neither he nor she had any such adventure before, and neither was conscious of any incongruity. Little by little he entangled his thoughts with hers. He lent her books, provided her with ideas, shared his intellectual life with her. She listened to all. Sometimes, in return for his theories, she gave out some fact of her own life. With almost maternal solicitude, she urged him to let his nature open to the full. She became his confessor. He told her that for some time he had assisted at the meetings of an Irish socialist party, where he had felt himself a unique figure amidst a score of sober workmen in a garret lit by an inefficient oil lamp. When the party had divided into three sections, each under its own leader and in its own garret, he had discontinued his attendances. The workmen's discussions, he said, were too timorous. The interest they took in the question of wages was inordinate. He felt that they were hard-featured realists and that they resented an exactitude which was the product of a leisure not within their reach. No social revolution, he told her, would be likely to strike Dublin for some centuries. She asked him why did he not write out his thoughts. For what? He asked her with careful scorn. To compete with phrasemongers incapable of thinking consecutively for 60 seconds? To submit himself to the criticisms of an obtuse middle class which entrusted its morality to policemen and its fine arts to impresarios? He went often to her little cottage outside Dublin. Often they spent their evenings alone. Little by little, as their thoughts entangled, they spoke of subjects less remote. Her companionship was like a warm soil about an exotic. Many times she allowed the dark to fall upon them, refraining from lighting the lamp. The dark, discreet room, their isolation, the music that still vibrated in their ears, united them. This union exalted him, wore away the rough edges of his character, emotionalized his mental life. Sometimes he caught himself listening to the sound of his own voice. He thought that in her eyes he would ascend to an angelical stature, and as he attached the fervent nature of his companion more and more closely to him, he heard the strange impersonal voice which he recognized as his own, insisting on the soul's incurable loneliness. "We cannot give ourselves," it said. "We are our own." The end of these discourses was that one night during which she had shown every sign of unusual excitement. Mrs. Sinico caught up his hand passionately and pressed it to her cheek. Mr. Duffy was very much surprised. Her interpretation of his words disillusioned him. He did not visit her for a week. Then he wrote to her, asking her to meet him. As he did not wish their last interview to be troubled by the influence of their ruined confessional, they met in a little cake shop near the park gate. It was cold autumn weather, but in spite of the cold, they wandered up and down the roads of the park for nearly 3 hours. They agreed to break off their intercourse. "Every bond," he said, "is a bond to sorrow." When they came out of the park, they walked in silence towards the tram. But here she began to tremble so violently that, fearing another collapse on her part, he bade her goodbye quickly and left her. A few days later he received a parcel containing his books and music. 4 years passed. Mr. Duffy returned to his even way of life. His room still bore witness of the orderliness of his mind. Some new pieces of music encumbered the music stand in the lower room, and on his shelves stood 2 volumes by Nietzsche, Thus Spake Zarathustra and The Gay Science. He wrote seldom in the sheaf of papers which lay in his desk. One of his sentences, written 2 months after his last interview with Mrs. Sinico, read, Love between man and man is impossible, because there must not be sexual intercourse. And friendship between man and woman is impossible, because there must be sexual intercourse. He kept away from concerts, lest he should meet her. His father died. The junior partner of the bank retired. And still, every morning, he went into the city by tram, and every evening walked home from the city after having dined moderately in Georgia Street and read the evening paper for dessert. One evening, as he was about to put a morsel of corned beef and cabbage into his mouth, his hand stopped. His eyes fixed themselves on a paragraph in the evening paper, which he had propped against the water carafe. He replaced the morsel of food on his plate and read the paragraph attentively. Then he drank a glass of water, pushed his plate to one side, doubled the paper down before him between his elbows, and read the paragraph over and over again. The cabbage began to deposit a cold white grease on his plate. The girl came over to him to ask was his dinner not properly cooked. He said it was very good, and ate a few mouthfuls of it with difficulty. Then he paid his bill, and went out. He walked along quickly through the November twilight, his stout hazel stick striking the ground regularly, the fringe of the buff mail peeping out of a side pocket of his tight reefer overcoat. On the lonely road which leads from the park gate to Chapel Izzard, he slackened his pace. His stick struck the ground less emphatically, and his breath, issuing irregularly, almost with a sighing sound, condensed in the wintry air. When he reached his house, he went up at once to his bedroom, and taking the paper from his pocket, read the paragraph again by the failing light of the window. He read it not aloud, but moving his lips as a priest does when he reads the prayers, Secreto. This was the paragraph. Death of a lady at Sydney Parade. A painful case. Today, at the City of Dublin Hospital, the deputy coroner, in the absence of Mr. Leverett, held an inquest on the body of Mrs. Emily Sinico, aged 43 years, who was killed at Sydney Parade Station yesterday evening. The evidence showed that the deceased lady, while attempting to cross the line, was knocked down by the engine of the 10 o'clock slow train from Kingston, thereby sustaining injuries of the head and right side, which led to her death. James Lennon, driver of the engine, stated that he had been in the employment of the railway company for 15 years. On hearing the guard's whistle, he set the train in motion, and a second or two afterwards brought it to rest in response to loud cries. The train was going slowly. P. Dunn, railway porter, stated that as the train was about to start, he observed a woman attempting to cross the lines. He ran towards her and shouted, but before he could reach her, she was caught by the buffer of the engine and fell to the ground. A juror, you saw the lady fall? Witness, yes. Police Sergeant Crowley deposed that when he arrived, he found the deceased lying on the platform, apparently dead. He had the body taken to the waiting room pending the arrival of the ambulance. Constable 57E corroborated. Dr. Halpin, assistant house surgeon of the City of Dublin Hospital, stated that the deceased had two lower ribs fractured and had sustained severe contusions of the right shoulder. The right side of the head had been injured in the fall. The injuries were not sufficient to have caused death in a normal person. Death, in his opinion, had been probably due to shock and sudden failure of the heart's action. Mr. H.B. Patterson Finlay, on behalf of the railway company, expressed his deep regret at the accident. The company had always taken every precaution to prevent people crossing the lines, except by the bridges, both by placing notices in every station and by the use of patent spring gates at level crossings. The deceased had been in the habit of crossing the lines late at night from platform to platform, and in view of certain other circumstances of the case, he did not think the railway officials were to blame. Captain Sinico of Leoville, Sydney Parade, husband of the deceased, also gave evidence. He stated that the deceased was his wife. He was not in Dublin at the time of the accident, as he had arrived only that morning from Rotterdam. They had been married for 22 years and had lived happily until about 2 years ago, when his wife began to be rather intemperate in her habits. Miss Mary Sinico said that of late her mother had been in the habit of going out at night to buy spirits. She, witness, had often tried to reason with her mother and had induced her to join a league. She was not at home until an hour after the accident. The jury returned a verdict in accordance with the medical evidence and exonerated Lennon from all blame. The deputy coroner said it was a most painful case and expressed great sympathy with Captain Sinico and his daughter. He urged on the railway company to take strong measures to prevent the possibility of similar accidents in the future. No blame attached to anyone. Mr. Duffy raised his eyes from the paper and gazed out of his window on the cheerless evening landscape. The river lay quiet beside the empty distillery, and from time to time a light appeared in some house on the Lucan Road. What an end! The whole narrative of her death revolted him, and it revolted him to think that he had ever spoken to her of what he held sacred. The threadbare phrases, the inane expressions of sympathy, the cautious words of a reporter won over to conceal the details of a commonplace, vulgar death, attacked his stomach. Not merely had she degraded herself, she had degraded him. He saw the squalid tract of her vice, miserable and malodorous, his soul's companion. He thought of the hobbling wretches whom he had seen carrying cans and bottles to be filled by the barman. Just God, what an end. Evidently she had been unfit to live, without any strength of purpose, an easy prey to habits, one of the wrecks on which civilization has been reared. But that she could have sunk so low. Was it possible he had deceived himself so utterly about her? He remembered her outburst of that night and interpreted it in a harsher sense than he had ever done. He had no difficulty now in approving of the course he had taken. As the light failed and his memory began to wander, he thought her hand touched his. The shock which had first attacked his stomach was now attacking his nerves. He put on his overcoat and hat quickly and went out. The cold air met him on the threshold. It crept into the sleeves of his coat. When he came to the public house at Chapel Lizard Bridge, he went in and ordered a hot punch. The proprietor served him obsequiously, but did not venture to talk. There were five or six working men in the shop, discussing the value of a gentleman's estate in County Kildare. They drank at intervals from their huge pint tumblers, and smoked, spitting often on the floor, and sometimes dragging the sawdust over their spits with their heavy boots. Mr. Duffy sat on his stool and gazed at them, without seeing or hearing them. After a while they went out, and he called for another punch. He sat a long time over it. The shop was very quiet. The proprietor sprawled on the counter, reading the Herald and yawning. Now and again a tram was heard swishing along the lonely road outside. As he sat there, living over his life with her and evoking alternately the two images in which he now conceived her, he realized that she was dead, that she had ceased to exist, that she had become a memory. He began to feel ill at ease. He asked himself what else could he have done. He could not have carried on a comedy of deception with her. He could not have lived with her openly. He had done what seemed to him best. How was he to blame? Now that she was gone, he understood how lonely her life must have been, sitting night after night alone in that room. His life would be lonely too, until he, too, died. Ceased to exist. Became a memory. If anyone remembered him. It was after 9 o'clock when he left the shop. The night was cold and gloomy. He entered the park by the first gate and walked along under the gaunt trees. He walked through the bleak alleys where they had walked 4 years before. She seemed to be near him in the darkness. At moments he seemed to feel her voice touch his ear. Her hand touch his. He stood still to listen. Why had he withheld life from her? Why had he sentenced her to death? He felt his moral nature falling to pieces. When he gained the crest of the Magazine Hill, he halted and looked along the river towards Dublin, the lights of which burned redly and hospitably in the cold night. He looked down the slope and at the base, in the shadow of the wall of the park. He saw some human figures lying. Those venal and furtive loves filled him with despair. He gnawed the rectitude of his life. He felt that he had been outcast from life's feast. One human being had seemed to love him, and he had denied her life and happiness. He had sentenced her to ignominy, a death of shame. He knew that the prostrate creatures down by the wall were watching him and wished him gone. No one wanted him. He was outcast from life's feast. He turned his eyes to the grey, gleaming river, winding along towards Dublin. Beyond the river, he saw a goods train winding out of Kingsbridge Station, like a worm with a fiery head, winding through the darkness, obstinately and laboriously. It passed slowly out of sight, but still he heard in his ears the laborious drone of the engine, reiterating the syllables of her name. He turned back the way he had come, the rhythm of the engine pounding in his ears. He began to doubt the reality of what memory told him. He halted under a tree and allowed the rhythm to die away. He could not feel her near him in the darkness, nor her voice touch his ear. He waited for some minutes listening. He could hear nothing. The night was perfectly silent. He listened again. Perfectly silent. He felt that he was alone.
Ivy Day in the committee room. Old Jack raked the cinders together with a piece of cardboard and spread them judiciously over the whitening dome of coals. When the dome was thinly covered, his face lapsed into darkness, but as he set himself to fan the fire again, his crouching shadow ascended the opposite wall, and his face slowly re-emerged into light. It was an old man's face, very bony and hairy. The moist blue eyes blinked at the fire, and the moist mouth fell open at times, munching once or twice mechanically when it closed. When the cinders had caught, he laid the piece of cardboard against the wall, sighed, and said, "That's better now, Mr. O'Connor." Mr. O'Connor, a grey-haired young man, whose face was disfigured by many blotches and pimples, had just brought the tobacco for a cigarette into a shapely cylinder, but when spoken to, he undid his handiwork meditatively. Then he began to roll the tobacco again meditatively, and after a moment's thought, decided to lick the paper.
"Did Mr. Tierney say when he'd be back?"
he asked in a husky falsetto. "He didn't say." Mr. O'Connor put his cigarette into his mouth and began to search his pockets. He took out a pack of thin pasteboard cards.
"I'll get you a match," said the old man.
"Never mind, this'll do," said Mr. O'Connor.
He selected one of the cards and read what was printed on it. Municipal Elections, Royal Exchange Ward, Mr. Richard J. Tierney, PLG, respectfully solicits the favour of your vote and influence at the coming election in the Royal Exchange Ward. Mr. O'Connor had been engaged by Mr. Tierney's agent to canvass one part of the ward, but as the weather was inclement and his boots let in the wet, he spent a great part of the day sitting by the fire in the committee room in Wicklow Street with Jack, the old caretaker. They had been sitting thus since the short day had grown dark. It was the 6th of October, dismal and cold out of doors. Mr. O'Connor tore a strip off the card and, lighting it, lit his cigarette. As he did so, the flame lit up a leaf of dark, glossy ivy in the lapel of his coat. The old man watched him attentively, and then, taking up the piece of cardboard again, began to fan the fire slowly while his companion smoked.
"Ah, yes," he said, continuing. "It's hard to know what way to bring up children. Now, who'd think he'd turn out like that? I sent him to the Christian Brothers, and I done what I could for him, and there he goes boozing about. I tried to make him some way decent." He replaced the cardboard wearily. "Only I'm an old man now," I change his tune for him. "I take the stick to his back and beat him while I could stand over him, as I done many a time before. The mother, you know, she cocks him up with this and that." "That's what ruins children," said Mr. O'Connor. "To be sure it is," said the old man. "And little thanks you get for it, only impudence. He takes the upper hand of me whenever he sees of a sup taken. What's the world coming to when sons speak that way to their father?"
"What age is he?"
said Mr. O'Connor.
19, said the old man.
"Why don't you put him to something?
Shrammet, I never done at the drunken bowsy ever since he left school. I won't keep you," I says. "You must get a job for yourself." "But sure, it's worse whenever he gets a job. He drinks it all."
Mr. O'Connor shook his head in sympathy, and the old man fell silent, gazing into the fire. Someone opened the door of the room and called out,
"Hello, is this a Freemasons meeting?"
"Who's that?"
said the old man.
"What are you doing in the dark?"
asked a voice.
"Is that you, Hines?"
asked Mr. O'Connor.
"Yes, what are you doing in the dark?"
said Mr. Hines, advancing into the light of the fire. He was a tall, slender young man with a light brown moustache. Imminent little drops of rain hung at the brim of his hat, and the collar of his jacket coat was turned up.
"Well, Matt," he said to Mr. O'Connor, "how goes it?"
Mr. O'Connor shook his head. The old man left the hearth, and after stumbling about the room, returned with two candlesticks, which he thrust one after the other into the fire and carried to the table. A denuded room came into view, and the fire lost all its cheerful colour. The walls of the room were bare, except for a copy of an election address. In the middle of the room was a small table on which papers were heaped. Mr. Hines leaned against the mantelpiece and asked,
"Has he paid you yet?"
"Not yet," said Mr. O'Connor. "I hope to God he'll not leave us in the lurch tonight."
Mr. Hines laughed.
"Oh, he'll pay you, never fear," he said.
"I hope he'll look smart about it if he means business," said Mr. O'Connor.
"What do you think, Jack?" said Mr. Hines satirically to the old man. The old man returned to his seat by the fire, saying,
"It isn't, but he has it, anyway, not like the other tinker."
"What other tinker?" said Mr. Hines.
"Colgan,"
said the old man scornfully.
"Is it because Colgan's a working man you say that? What's the difference between a good honest bricklayer and a publican, huh? Hasn't a working man as good a right to be in the corporation as anyone else? Aye, and a better right than those shenanigans that are always hat in hand before any fellow with a handle to his name. Isn't that so, Matt?"
said Mr. Hines, addressing Mr. O'Connor.
"I think you're right," said Mr. O'Connor. "One man is a plain, honest man with no hunker sliding about him. He goes in to represent the labour classes. This fellow you're working for only wants to get some job or other." "Of course the working class should be represented," said the old man.
"The working man," said Mr. Hines, "gets all kicks and no halfpence. But
But it's labour produces everything. The working man is not looking for fat jobs for his sons and nephews and cousins. The working man is not going to drag the honour of Dublin in the mud to please a German monarch.
How's that? Said the old man.
Don't you know they want to present an address of welcome to Edward Rex if he comes here next year? What do we want kowtowing to a foreign king?
Our man won't vote for the address, said Mr. O'Connor. He goes in on the nationalist's ticket.
Won't he?
Said Mr. Hines.
Wait till you see whether he will or not. I know him. Is it Tricky Dicky Tierney?
By God, perhaps you're right, Joe, said Mr. O'Connor. Anyway, I wish he'd torn up with the Spondulics. The three men fell silent. The old man began to rake more cinders together. Mr. Hines took off his hat, shook it, and then turned down the collar of his coat, displaying as he did so an ivy leaf in the lapel.
If this man was alive, he said, pointing to the leaf, we'd have no talk of an address of welcome.
That's true, said Mr. O'Connor.
Musha, God be with them times, said the old man.
There was some life in it then. The room was silent again. Then a bustling little man with a snuffling nose and very cold ears pushed in the door. He walked over quickly to the fire, rubbing his hands as if he intended to produce a spark from them.
No money, boys, he said. Sit down here, Mr. Henchy, said the old man, offering him his chair. Oh, don't stir, Jack, don't stir, said Mr. Henchy.
He nodded curtly to Mr. Hines and sat down on the chair which the old man vacated.
Did you serve Ainger Street?
He asked Mr. O'Connor.
Yes,
said Mr. O'Connor, beginning to search his pockets for memoranda.
Did you call on Grimes?
I did.
Well, how's he stand?
He wouldn't promise.
He said, I won't tell anyone what way I'm going to vote.
Well, I think he'd be all right.
Why so?
He asked me who the nominators were, and I told him. I mentioned Father Burke's name. I think it'll be all right.
Mr. Henchy began to snuffle and to rub his hands over the fire at a terrific speed. Then he said,
For the love of God, Jack, bring us a bit of coal. There must be some left.
The old man went out of the room. It's no go, said Mr. Henchy, shaking his head. I asked the little shoeboy, but he said,
Oh, now, Mr. Henchy, when I see the work going on properly, I won't forget you, you may be sure.
Mean little tinker.
Usha, how could he be anything else?
What did I tell you, Matt? Said Mr. Hines.
Tricky Dicky Tierney.
Oh, he's tricky as they make him, said Mr. Henchy. He hasn't got those little pig's eyes for nothing. Blast his soul! Couldn't he pay up like a man instead of,
Oh, now, Mr. Henchy, you must speak to Mr. Fanning. I've spent a lot of money.
Mean little shoeboy of hell. I suppose he forgets the time his little old father kept the hand-me-down shop in Mary's Lane.
But is that a fact? Asked Mr. O'Connor.
God, yes! Said Mr. Henchy. Did you never hear that? And the men used to go in on Sunday morning before the houses were open to buy a waistcoat or a trousers. Moya! But Tricky Dicky's little old father always had a tricky little black bottle up in a corner. Do you mind now? That's that. That's where he first saw the light.
The old man returned with a few lumps of coal, which he placed here and there on the fire.
That's a nice how do you do,
said Mr. O'Connor.
How does he expect us to work for him if he won't stump up?
I can't help it, said Mr. Henchy. I expect to find the bailiffs in the hall when I go home.
Mr. Hines laughed, and shoving himself away from the mantelpiece with the aid of his shoulders, made ready to leave.
It'll be all right when King Eddie comes, he said. Well, boys, I'm off for the present. See you later. Bye-bye.
He went out of the room slowly. Neither Mr. Henchy nor the old man said anything. But just as the door was closing, Mr. O'Connor, who had been staring moodily into the fire, called out suddenly,
Hi, Joe!
Mr. Henchy waited a few moments and then nodded in the direction of the door. Tell me, he said across the fire, what brings our friend in here? What does he want?
Usha, poor Joe, said Mr. O'Connor, throwing the end of his cigarette into the fire.
He's hard up like the rest of us.
Mr. Henchy snuffled vigorously and spat so copiously that he nearly put out the fire, which uttered a hissing protest.
"To tell you my private and candid opinion," he said, "I think he's a man from the other camp. He's a spy of Colgan's, if you ask me. Just go round and try and find out how they're getting on. They won't suspect you. Do you twig?"
"Ah, poor Joe is a decent skin," said Mr. O'Connor.
His father was a decent, respectable man, Mr. Henshey admitted. Poor old Larry Hines. Many a good turn he did in his day. But I'm greatly afraid our friend is not 19 carat. Damn it, I can understand a fellow being hard up, but what I can't understand is a fellow sponging. Couldn't he have some spark of manhood about him? He doesn't get a warm welcome from me when he comes, said the old man. Let him work for his own side and not come spying round here. I don't know, said Mr. O'Connor dubiously, as he took out cigarette papers and tobacco. I think Joe Hines is a straight man. He's a clever chap, too, with the pen. Do you remember that thing he wrote? Some of these hillsiders and Fenians are a bit too clever, if you ask me, said Mr. Henshey. Do you know what my private and candid opinion is about some of these little jokers? I believe half of them are in the pay of the castle.
There's no knowing, said the old man.
Oh, but I know for a fact, said Mr. Henshey. They're castle hacks. I don't say Hines. No, damn it, I think he's a stroke above that, but there's a certain little nobleman with a cock eye. You know the patriot I'm alluding to? Mr. O'Connor nodded. There's a lineal descendant of Major Surfer, if you like. Oh, the heart's blood of a patriot. That's a fellow now that'd sell his country for fourpence, aye, and go down on his bended knees and thank the almighty Christ he had a country to sell. There was a knock at the door. Come in, said Mr. Henshey. A person resembling a poor clergyman or a poor actor appeared in the doorway. His black clothes were tightly buttoned on his short body, and it was impossible to say whether he wore a clergyman's collar or a layman's, because the collar of his shabby frock coat, the uncovered buttons of which reflected the candlelight, was turned up about his neck. He wore a round hat of hard black felt. His face, shining with raindrops, had the appearance of damp yellow cheese, save where two rosy spots indicated the cheekbones. He opened his very long mouth suddenly to express disappointment, and at the same time opened wide his very bright blue eyes to express pleasure and surprise. "Oh, Father Caon," said Mr. Henshey, jumping up from his chair. "Is that you? Come in."
"Oh, no, 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 no,"
said Father Caon quickly, pursing his lips as if he were addressing a child. "Won't you come in and sit down?"
"No, no, no, no," said Father Caon, speaking in a discreet, indulgent, velvety voice. "Don't let me disturb you now. I'm just looking for Mr. Fanning."
"He's round at the Black Eagle," said Mr. Henshey. "But won't you come in and sit down a minute?"
"No, no, thank you. It was just a little business matter," said Father Caon. "Thank you, indeed."
He retreated from the doorway, and Mr. Henshey, seizing one of the candlesticks, went to the door to light him downstairs.
"Oh, don't trouble, I beg. No, but the stairs are so dark." "No, no, I can see. Thank you, indeed. Are you right now?" "All right, thanks. Thanks."
Mr. Henshey returned with the candlestick and put it on the table. He sat down again at the fire. There was silence for a few moments. "Tell me, John," said Mr. O'Connor, lighting his cigarette with another pasteboard card.
"Hm? What is he exactly?"
"Ask me an easier one," said Mr. Henshey.
"Fanning and himself seem to me very thick. They're often in cabins together. Is he a priest at all?"
Yes, I believe so. I think he's what you call a black sheep. We haven't many of them, thank God, but we have a few. He's an unfortunate man of some kind."
"And how did he knock it out?"
asked Mr. O'Connor. "That's another mystery."
"Is he attached to any chapel or church or institution, or—"
"No," said Mr. Henshey. "I think he's travelling on his own account. God forgive me," he added. "I thought he was the dozen of stout."
"Is there any chance of a drink itself?" asked Mr. O'Connor.
"I'm dry too," said the old man. "I asked that little shoeboy 3 times, said Mr. Henshey, "would he send up a dozen of stout? I asked him again now, but he was leaning on the counter in his shirt sleeves having a deep goster with Alderman Cowley."
"Why didn't you remind him?" said Mr. O'Connor.
"Well, I couldn't go over while he was talking to Alderman Cowley. I just waited till I caught his eye and said, 'About that little matter I was speaking to you about.' 'That'll be all right, Mr. H,' he said. 'Your ash with the little hop in me tum has forgotten all about it.'"
"There's some deal on in that quarter," said Mr. O'Connor thoughtfully. "I saw the 3 of them hard at it yesterday at Suffolk Street Corner."
"I think I know the little game they're at," said Mr. Henshey. "You must owe the city fathers money nowadays if you want to be made Lord Mayor.
By God, I'm thinking seriously of becoming a city father myself. What do you think? Would I do for the job?
Mr. O'Connor laughed.
So far as owing money goes.
Driving out with the mansion house, said Mr. Henshey, and all my vermin, with Jack here standing up behind me in a powdered wig, huh?
And make me your private secretary, John.
Yes, and I'll make Father Keown my private chaplain. We'll have a family party. Faith, Mr. Henshey, said the old man. You'd keep up better style than some of them. I was talking one day to old Keegan, the porter.
And how do you like your new master, Pat, says I to him.
You haven't much entertaining now, says I.
Entertaining, says he. He'd live on the smell of an oil rag.
And do you know what he told me? Now, I declare to God I didn't believe him.
What? Said Mr. Henshey and Mr. O'Connor.
He told me, what do you think of a Lord Mayor of Dublin sending out for a pound of chops for his dinner? How's that for high living, says he.
Whoosh, whoosh, says I. A pound of chops, says he, coming into the mansion house.
Whoosh, says I. What kind of people is going along now?
At this point there was a knock at the door and a boy put in his head.
What is it? Said the old man.
From the Black Eagle,
said the boy, walking in sideways and depositing a basket on the floor with a noise of shaken bottles. The old man helped the boy to transfer the bottles from the basket to the table and counted the full tally. After the transfer, the boy put his basket on his arm and asked,
any bottles?
What bottles? Said the old man.
Won't you let us drink them first?
Said Mr. Henshey.
I was told to ask for bottles.
Come back tomorrow, said the old man.
Here, boy, said Mr. Henshey. Will you run over to O'Farrell's and ask him to lend us a corkscrew? For Mr. Henshey, say. Tell him we won't keep it a minute. Leave the basket there.
The boy went out and Mr. Henshey began to rub his hands cheerfully, saying,
ah, well, he's not so bad after all. He's as good as his word, anyhow.
There's no tumblers, said the old man.
Oh, don't let that trouble you, Jack, said Mr. Henshey. Many's the good man before now drank out of the bottle.
Anyway,
it's better than nothing, said Mr. O'Connor.
He's not a bad sort, said Mr. Henshey. Only Fanny has such a loan of him. He means well, you know, in his own tin pot way.
The boy came back with the corkscrew. The old man opened three bottles and was handing back the corkscrew when Mr. Henshey said to the boy, would you like a drink, boy?
If you please, sir, said the boy.
The old man opened another bottle grudgingly and handed it to the boy.
What age are you?
He asked.
17,
said the boy. As the old man said nothing further, the boy took the bottle, said,
here's my best respects, sir, to Mr. Henshey,
drank the contents, put the bottle back on the table and wiped his mouth with his sleeve. Then he took up the corkscrew and went out of the door sideways, muttering some form of salutation.
That's the way it begins, said the old man.
The thin end of the wedge, said Mr. Henshey. The old man distributed the three bottles which he had opened, and the men drank from them simultaneously. After having drunk, each placed his bottle on the mantelpiece within hand's reach and drew in a long breath of satisfaction.
Well, I did a good day's work today, said Mr. Henshey after a pause.
That's all, John.
Yes, I got him one or two sure things in Dawson Street, Crofton and myself. Between ourselves, you know, Crofton, he's a decent chap, of course, but he's not worth a damn as a canvasser. He hasn't a word to throw to a dog. He stands and looks at the people while I do the talking.
Here two men entered the room. One of them was a very fat man, whose blue serge clothes seemed to be in danger of falling from his sloping figure. He had a big face, which resembled a young ox's face in expression, staring blue eyes and a grizzled moustache. The other man, who was much younger and frailer, had a thin, clean-shaven face. He wore a very high double collar and a wide-brimmed bowler hat.
"Hello, Crofton," said Mr. Henshey to the fat man. "Talk of the devil." "Where did the booze come from?" asked the young man. "Did the cow calve?"
"Oh, of course, lion spots to drink first thing,"
said Mr. O'Connor, laughing.
"Is that the way you chaps canvass?" said Mr. Lyons. "And Crofton and I out in the cold and rain looking for votes?"
"Why, blast your soul," said Mr. Henshey. "I'd get more votes in 5 minutes than you two'd get in a week."
"Open two bottles of stout, Jack," said Mr. O'Connor.
"How can I?"
said the old man, when there's no corkscrew. Wait now, said Mr. Henchy, getting up quickly. Did you ever see this little trick? He took two bottles from the table, and carrying them to the fire, put them on the hob. Then he sat down again by the fire and took another drink from his bottle. Mr. Lyons sat on the edge of the table, pushed his hat towards the nape of his neck, and began to swing his legs. "Which is my bottle?" he asked. "This lad," said Mr. Henchy. Mr. Crofton sat down on a box and looked fixedly at the other bottle on the hob. He was silent for two reasons. The first reason, sufficient in itself, was that he had nothing to say. The second reason was that he considered his companions beneath him. He had been a canvasser for Wilkins, the Conservative, but when the Conservatives had withdrawn their man and, choosing the lesser of two evils, given their support to the Nationalist candidate, he had been engaged to work for Mr. Tierney. In a few minutes, an apologetic pock was heard as the cork flew out of Mr. Lyons' bottle. Mr. Lyons jumped off the table, went to the fire, took his bottle, and carried it back to the table.
"I was just telling them, Crofton," said Mr. Henchy, "that we got a good few votes today."
"Who did you get?" asked Mr. Lyons.
"Well, I got Perks, for one, and I got Atkinson, for two, and I got Ward off Dawson Street. Fine old chap he is too, regular old tough old Conservative."
"But isn't your candidate a Nationalist?" said he.
"He's a respectable man," said I. "He's in favour of whatever will benefit this country. He's a big ratepayer," I said. "He's extensive house property in the city and three places of business. And isn't it to his own advantage to keep down the rates? He's a prominent and respected citizen," said I, "and a poor law guardian, and he doesn't belong to any party, good, bad, or indifferent." That's the way to talk to him.
"And what about the address to the king?" said Mr. Lyons, after drinking and smacking his lips.
"Listen to me," said Mr. Henchy. "What we want in this country, as I said to old Ward, is capital. The king's coming here will mean an influx of money into this country. The citizens of Dublin will benefit by it. Look at all the factories down by the quays there, idle. Look at all the money there is in the country if we only worked the old industries, the mills, the shipbuilding yards and factories. It's capital we want."
"But look here, John," said Mr. O'Connor. "Why should we welcome the King of England? Didn't Parnell himself..."
"Parnell," said Mr. Henchy, "is dead. Now here's the way I look at it. Here's this chap come to the throne after his own mother keeping him out of it till the man was grey. He's a man of the world, and he means well by us. He's a jolly fine, decent fellow, if you ask me, and no damn nonsense about him. He just says to himself, 'The old one never went to see these wild Irish. By Christ, I'll go myself and see what they're like.' And are we going to insult the man when he comes over here on a friendly visit, huh? It's not right, Crofton."
Mr. Crofton nodded his head.
"But after all now," said Mr. Lyons argumentatively, "King Edward's life, you know, is not the very..."
"Let bygones be bygones," said Mr. Henchy.
"I admire the man personally. He's just an ordinary knockabout like you and me. He's fond of his glass of grog, and he's a bit of a rake, perhaps, and he's a good sportsman. Damn it, can't we Irish play fair?"
"That's all very fine," said Mr. Lyons. "But look at the case of Parnell now."
"In the name of God," said Mr. Henchy, "where is the analogy between the two cases? What I mean," said Mr. Lyons, "is we have our ideals. Why now would we welcome a man like that? Do you think now, after what he did, Parnell was a fit man to lead us? And why then would we do it for Edward the Seventh?"
"This is Parnell's anniversary," said Mr. O'Connor, "and don't let us stir up any bad blood. We all respect him now that he's dead and gone, even the Conservatives," he added, turning to Mr. Crofton.
Puck!
The tardy cork flew out of Mr. Crofton's bottle. Mr. Crofton got up from his box and went to the fire. As he returned with his capture, he said in a deep voice, "Our side of the house respect him, because he was a gentleman."
"Right you are, Crofton," said Mr. Henchy fiercely. "He was the only man that could keep that bag of cats in order. Down, ye dogs! Lie down, ye curs!"
"That's the way he treated them. Come in, Joe, come in," he called out, catching sight of Mr. Hines in the doorway. Mr. Hines came in slowly.
"Open another bottle of stout, Jack," said Mr. Henchy. "Oh, I forgot there's no corkscrew. Here, show me one here and I'll put it at the fire."
The old man handed him another bottle, and he placed it on the hob. "Sit down, Joe," said Mr. O'Connor. "We're just talking about the chief."
"Aye, aye," said Mr. Henchy.
Mr. Hines sat on the side of the table near Mr. Lyons, but said nothing.
"There's one of them anyhow," said Mr. Henchy, "that didn't renege him. By God, I'll say for you, Joe. No, by God, you stuck to him like a man."
"Oh, Joe," said Mr. O'Connor suddenly. "Give us that thing you wrote. Do you remember? Have you got it on you?"
"Oh, aye," said Mr. Henchy. "Give us that. Did you ever hear that, Crofton? Listen to this now. Splendid thing."
"Go on," said Mr. O'Connor. "Fire it away, Joe."
Mr. Hines did not seem to remember at once the piece to which they were alluding, but after reflecting a while, he said,
"Oh, that thing, is it? Sure, that's old now."
"Out with it, man," said Mr. O'Connor.
"Shh," said Mr. Henchy.
"Now, Joe."
Mr. Hines hesitated a little longer. Then, amid the silence, he took off his hat, laid it on the table, and stood up. He seemed to be rehearsing the piece in his mind. After a rather long pause, he announced,
"The Death of Parnell, 6th of October, 1891.
He cleared his throat once or twice, and then began to recite.
"He is dead. Our uncrowned king is dead. O Aaron, mourn with grief and woe, for he lies dead whom the fell gang of modern hypocrites laid low. He lies slain by the coward hounds. He raised to glory from the mire, and Aaron's hopes and Aaron's dreams perish upon her monarch's pyre. In palace, cabin, or in cot, the Irish heart, wherever it be, is bowed with woe, for he is gone. Who would have wrought our destiny? He would have had his Aaron famed, the green flag gloriously unfurled, her statesmen, bards, and warriors raised before the nations of the world. He dreamed, alas, 'twas but a dream, of liberty. But as he strove to clutch that idol, treachery sundered him from the thing he loved. Shame on the coward caitiff hands that smote their lord, or with a kiss betrayed him to the rabble rout of fawning priests, no friends of his. May everlasting shame consume the memory of those who tried to befoul and smear the exalted name of one who spurned them in his pride. He fell as fall the mighty ones, nobly undaunted to the last, and death has now united him with Aaron's heroes of the past. No sound of strife disturb his sleep. Calmly he rests. No human pain or high ambition spurs him now the peaks of glory to attain. They had their way, they laid him low, but Aaron, list, his spirit may rise like the phoenix from the flames when breaks the dawning of the day that brings us freedom's reign. And on that day may Aaron well pledge in the cup she lifts to joy, one grief, the memory of Parnell."
Mr. Hines sat down again on the table. When he had finished his recitation, there was a silence, and then a burst of clapping. Even Mr. Lyons clapped. The applause continued for a little time. When it had ceased, all the auditors drank from their bottles in silence.
Puck! The cork flew out of Mr. Hines' bottle, but Mr. Hines remained sitting, flushed and bareheaded, on the table. He did not seem to have heard the invitation.
"Good man, Joe," said Mr. O'Connor, taking out his cigarette papers and pouch, the better to hide his emotion.
"What do you think of that, Crofton?" cried Mr. Henchy. "Isn't that fine?"
"What?"
Mr. Crofton said that it was a very fine piece of writing. A Mother. Mr. Holohan, Assistant Secretary of the Era Abu Society, had been walking up and down Dublin for nearly a month, with his hands and pockets full of dirty pieces of paper, arranging about the series of concerts. He had a game leg, and for this his friends called him Hoppy Holohan. He walked up and down constantly, stood by the hour at street corners, arguing the point,
and made notes, but in the end it was Mrs. Kearney who arranged everything. Miss Devlin had become Mrs. Kearney out of spite. She had been educated in a high-class convent where she had learned French and music. As she was naturally pale and unbending in manner, she made few friends at school. When she came to the age of marriage, she was sent out to many houses where her playing and ivory manners were much admired. She sat amid the chilly circle of her accomplishments, waiting for some suitor to brave it and offer her a brilliant life. But the young men whom she met were ordinary, and she gave them no encouragement, trying to console her romantic desires by eating a great deal of Turkish delight in secret. However, when she drew near the limit and her friends began to loosen their tongues about her, she silenced them by marrying Mr. Kearney, who was a bootmaker on Ormond Quay. He was much older than she. His conversation, which was serious, took place at intervals in his great brown beard. After the first year of married life, Mrs. Kearney perceived that such a man would wear better than a romantic person, but she never put her own romantic ideas away. He was sober, thrifty, and pious. He went to the altar every first Friday, sometimes with her, oftener by himself. But she never weakened in her religion and was a good wife to him. At some party in a strange house, when she lifted her eyebrow ever so slightly, he stood up to take his leave, and when his cough troubled him, she put the eiderdown quilt over his feet and made a strong rum punch. For his part, he was a model father. By paying a small sum every week into a society, he ensured for both his daughters a dowry of £100 each when they came to the age of 24. He sent the elder daughter, Kathleen, to a good convent, where she learned French and music, and afterwards paid her fees at the academy. Every year in the month of July, Mrs. Kearney found occasion to say to some friend, "My good man is packing us off to Skerries for a few weeks." If it was not Skerries, it was Howth or Greystone.